I assume we can begin the class. I want to thank the Kollel for initiating this learning, taking advantage of the technology and bring more Torah learning to us. And since I only have half an hour, I want to begin. I chose to devote the next few weeks in this half hour. I chose to devote it to study, to talk about the subject of tefillah, the subject of prayer. I must confess before I begin that. Let me just mute everyone here. I don't think I could do it from my end. I want to confess by saying that tefillah, the subject of tefillah, I found it to be from the most difficult subjects to grow in and find meaning, concentration. I've always found the subject of tefillah, I always had a dilemma with a difficulty, but I always found difficulties with tefillah. And the dilemma that I always had was as follows. There have been situations, everyone may find such situations in their lives, where tefillah was not a challenge at all. The most memorable davenings that I had, that I have till today, were the times that my wife was in labor, being in the hospital, before childbirth. And these occasions for me have been the most memorable times in terms of connecting with davening, connecting with prayer. And here, I don't remember any difficulties. No difficulties whatsoever to concentrate, to find the right words, to find the right meaning within the chapters of Psalms, of Tehillim, that I would be saying at those moments. In fact, there's certain verses that till today I remember, oh, these were the verses that I said when so-and-so was born. I remember those words. So I'm not here to say that I never encountered great meaning, great connection with tefillah, with davening. Perhaps one can say there's no atheist in a foxhole, an individual in such moments when it's so clear that everything is in Hashem's hands and no one really is in control of the situation. It just, the baby will be born, God willing, and God willing, the baby will be healthy and the mother will be healthy, but the staff around has zero control over the situation. These are that I don't ever remember difficulties with davening. However, the daily davening, that which we are obligated to do three times a day, Shacharis, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, seems to be very repetitive. We say that all the time. For me, on a personal level, this has always been a challenge, always been a challenge. The reason why I chose to not speak about tefillah is because I sense in the last couple of weeks, we have been confined to our homes. I finally experience a breakthrough in the connection of davening, in the meaning of davening. And when I finally broke through the subject, I thought that now it's a personal topic for me that hopefully I could share with you not only some of my experiences, but the connection and the understanding from the beautiful sources that we have, how an individual can connect better with davening. So we could present the difficulty in davening in various different ways. I already mentioned before the fact that it may be repetitive. The fact that it's repetitive, that can pose a challenge. There can be other challenges that come along with connecting with prayer. That is the question, or the question whether my davening really matters. That can be on different fronts, in different ways the challenge can be expressed. One is when we deal with such global matters. We're talking about impacting the universe, talking about impacting the world, speaking about the coming of Mashiach, the end of our exile, the end of our galus. These are huge subjects that we're going on for hundreds and thousands of years. And it's very obvious where an individual can even begin with some disbelief. What can I do about it? Much greater people have been before me and they did not seem to be successful. They didn't seem to be successful with their prayers. That is on a global level. So what will I contribute to that? When we speak about personal matters, there too, a challenge can rise when a person, God forbid, whether them in the family, community, may go through a challenge. Could be a very personal challenge. Somebody in the family, a family member, can be ill or very ill. And it has happened and happens all the time that we try to bring intensity and connection to our davening with great hopes that that will change things. And the end does not meet. We don't seem to see the results that we hoped for. So that too can be a challenge to come up. But even if these challenges, these are big topics, and hopefully I will be able in the next few weeks, I will want to address these questions that we have in prayer. These are not the reasons why I had a hard time davening. By me, I have experienced the difficulty with davening to be a matter of focus, difficulty to focus, difficult to concentrate on every word, have the proper intent on every word. And especially, again, I'm talking only about myself. Doing that by rote for many, many years. Yes, I know the davening by heart. And how often an individual can find themselves at the end of a Shmoneh Esrei, at the end of davening, with such a sense of feel, oh, here I blew it again. Where was I in the last 3-4 minutes? I know I davened, I know I said the words, and I do want, we could rest assured that even if an individual said the words and did not have the proper intent, it does have value. It does have value, but it's discouraging. It's discouraging to want to experience davening over and over and find difficulty with focus. One of the reasons why we have a hard time focusing is because we're in constant rush. We have a mindset. We're always in a rush. Is that the ultimate reason? So what happens on Shabbos? Could I have said with certainty that I always felt Shabbos davening was way different than the weekday? Not quiet. A little bit better. Yes, a little bit easier. But I can't say that davening was completely the ideal davening that I was hoping for. So, yes, so here I'm sharing with you. On one end, it's very personal. It's very personal difficulty in connecting with davening. But here I shared with you, I mentioned to you a breakthrough that I had in the last couple of weeks, to which, on a personal level, if this entire corona situation closing down over shul brought that to me on a personal level, I hope I should be able to say that I gained something from it. I have in the back of my mind that which Rabbi Meyer mentioned. He spoke very strongly before the holiday of Pesach, wondering, questioning, demanding, are we going to be back once, God willing, the subject of this whole corona will be behind us, and we will be back in our shuls, we'll be back to our daily davening, we're going to be back to a normal life. Are we going to go back to the same old life? It's a very demanding question. It's a very, very, very demanding question. I appreciate it very, very much. Rabbi Meyer demanded from us to ask the question to ourselves. And yes, and I'm asking the question to myself almost every day, almost every Shabbos table, around the table with our family. That is what we are discussing. And I'm not going to say that I am certain that I found the cure, or I found the answer, how, God willing, when we come back, will be completely different.
But only 12 people.
But I could hope. I could hope. But the best I could do, I could hope that the information I'm going to share with you will serve, at least for myself, not only as a breakthrough during this time, but rather during the future, God willing. Okay, so I raised the challenges, and I raised the various reasons why we have challenges. And here I want to share with you the perspective that I developed. I do want to say that I don't know if you're all aware. I don't know who exactly is on the call here, but out there in the big Jewish communities, the subject of not closing down the minyan, or returning, or the rush of returning back to daven with a minyan, is a big subject out there. And I'm not here to state an opinion, not medically and not halachically, at what point this is something that needs to be done. That's not my place. However, what I do want to say, that I have been wondering, with a breakthrough that I experienced davening at home, I don't understand on a personal level why people are in such a rush to get back to minyan. Is it the pure mitzvah of it? Could be. There's no question about it that there is. It's a tremendous inyan, a tremendous concept to daven with a minyan. But the part of me is treasuring so much the new experience of tefillah that I'm going to share with you, that I am not desperate to get back to shul on a personal level after I met this breakthrough. So let's get to the point. So what is that breakthrough? Let me share with you the following. There is a Gemara, it's a Gemara in Brachos, on page Daf Vav Amud Beis, page 6b, that says the following statement. The Gemara says, brings down from the name of one of the greatest sages, Rav Huna. Omar Rav Chelboy, Omar Rav Huna. Rav Huna stated the following. I will read it in Hebrew, and I will translate it. Kol akoyveya mokoim letfilosoy, Elokei Avraham yebe Ezroi. A person who sets himself a set place to daven, they don't bounce from place to place where they stand during services, rather they always stand in one place. So the Gemara says, Elokei Avraham yebe Ezroi. God of Abraham will be with him, will assist him. Rashi says something quite remarkable. Rashi says, Kederech shehoya oizer le'Avram, in the same way that Hashem assisted Abraham, the Shpocha provided siyata, Hashem provided much assistance to Avram, that same assistance will be provided to you if you have a set place to daven.
Uh-oh.
wait, we're not done yet.
Continue. I've been moving around the house.
Okay, wait. Continues the Gemara and says, and you know what's going to be? This is an eternal reward, but listen to this. The Gemara say, it's a funny way how it says it. His eulogy, he can know in advance what his eulogy will be. Ukesha Mace, when this person is going to pass on, you know what people will say about him? Oimrim Loi, people will say to him, more correctly, about him, people will say the following words. Listen to the words. Hey, Onov. Look at this humble man. A chassid. Look at this pious Jew. Mital midov shel Avraham Avinu. He is a disciple of our patriarch Avraham. So, if you want to know what your eulogy will be after 120, the Gemara tells you what to do. Have an assigned seat for davening. This is a very difficult Gemara to understand. Having a seat to daven, how does that, first, the Gemara promises the individual measure of heavenly assistance, measure of siyata dishmaya, just like Avraham Avinu. That's a biggie. That's a big reward for what? For having an assigned seat in shul? And secondly, who are we fooling? Are we saying that this individual, he's the humble man? This person is the pious man? This obviously needs understanding. So again, I don't know who is here on the call. you're more than welcome to follow me on the source that I'm making a reference to. I'm quoting now from Rabbi Nayona. Rabbi Nayona is one of the great early commentators, one of the Rishonim, who comments on this Gemara. The first thing that he says is almost shocking. Listen to this. Look how apropos it is for us. Says Rabbi Nayona, that I will just translate that. Says Rabbi Nayona, you should know that this statement of having an assigned seat for davening does not apply to shul. That's the first thing that he says. Loy omar ze b'mekoymoy shel beis hakneses. The statement does not apply for the one who davens in shul. And he explains why, because the entire place of the shul is considered to be mokoym tefillah, is a place where people daven, so it doesn't matter where you sit. Now, I don't know if this Rabbi Nayona is the way this halacha is actually brought out in halacha. I did not check. But here, we're certainly going to hear a very interesting perspective. So Rabbi Nayona again says that the idea of having a signed seat that will give one the reward that we just mentioned, and his eulogy is set in a good place, that's not for a person, not for davening at home. Rather, Ella Rotzoloima. Rather, this means to say, listen, I have to say that in Hebrew, Shemokom Shekoiveya Mokom Letfilosoi Bebesoi. The individual should set an assigned place for him to daven in his home. He needs to give an excuse why would a person daven at home. At times, an individual cannot go to shul, so he needs to daven at home. Oh, how apropos is that for us today? Okay, so at times an individual cannot make it to shul, so such a person should daven at home. On him, we say that when you daven at home, you should have one set place for davening. I'm continuing on in Rabbi Nayona, and I do want to say that I see that I have 7 minutes left. We will need to continue this next week. Happened to be that Rabbi Nayona brings down from Talmud Yerushalmi, where in the Jerusalem Talmud, it says it explicitly. When it introduces the concept of one who sets a set place for davening, he uses the words, Akoveya mokom letfilosoi bebesoi, a person, anyone who sets a set place for him in his home to daven. What's the purpose? The Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi adds the words that the idea of him having a set place, he sets a place, and I'm going to use these wonderful words, ke'ilu hikifo mechitzoi shel barzel. The individual is in a place as if he is surrounded with walls of iron, walls, there is a protective shield around him, how he is in his place. So that's first simply the meaning of what the Gemara requires. When a person davens at home, he should have a set place. Questions, Rabbeinu Yaina, the question that we asked before. It is so difficult to understand, he says, to use such a praise that this is the individual, referring to the eulogy of the person. This person is a pious man. This person is a pious man and a humble person. Says Rabbeinu Yoina, questions, is this enough of a reason? To give such great praise to this man? Comes along Rabbi Nayona. I will only begin by saying the answer, and I will need to continue this because I only have half an hour. So I welcome you to join back again next week for this tefillah class, says Rabbi Nayona. And I need to give a closure to this by saying quickly like this. And one must say, it was this great reward was not merely given for a person having a set place. Rather, an individual, listen, such beautiful words. When an individual cares that his davening will be special, and he uses the words, and he loves davening so much, kol kach hu oyhei v'hatfila. Ever heard that expression? Loving to daven? Enjoying it, loving it so much? Hopefully we'll get to it. An individual who sets a place, he's an individual who sets a special place because he loves davening so much. Vadai midas anova yeshboy. Without a doubt, that person possesses the trait of humility. He certainly has a trait of humility, so his davening should be accepted by Hashem. I'm going to say that sentence, I'm continuing on by saying, because if he does not have humility, there is no possible way for him to daven with proper intent. And therefore, his davening will not be accepted by the Almighty. However, this person merit anava, the person merit to be humble, he will even merit to become a pious individual, which is even a greater level, as he quotes from the Gemara that says, anava mevioli de chasidus, a person who is humble, the next step in the rung of the ladder, he will become a pious man. And will come out that because this individual was so careful with davening, he will merit those character traits of being humble and being pious. And that is what they're going to say about him when he's going to pass on from the world. What Rabbi Yonah is touching is that which we are going to elaborate later on. And that is the concept of humility is necessary for in order to have proper intent. And when the person will have the proper intent, his davening will be accepted. It sounds to us something new. This is a whole new information, new concept, where humility comes into our prayers. With the fact that my time is up, at this point, my encouragement to myself, along with the listeners, that those who daven at home should have a set place to daven, because that seems to be connected to humility, which will help him have proper intent, which because of that, his prayer will be accepted. And because he will attain this level of humility, he will also eventually attain and acquire the trait of pious, being pious, chasidus. My time is up. I appreciate those who came on. I see Rabbi Malamed is already on, and I don't want to take from him. So those of you who would like to come back, you're more than welcome to, number one, stay for the next class, and number two, to come back next Sunday. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to reiterate that if anyone has any questions, feel free to chime in with any questions. So first of all, I want to say it's a great privilege to speak to all of you, and it's a big chizik. It's a big thing that we're coming together to work on understanding and knowing the halacha, the proper law. To know properly is a big thing to be able to do that. So we're going to discuss the laws of brachas, and this year today, which is just the beginning of the series, I'd like to first talk about a general overview about the idea behind brachos, not even in the realm of halacha, but more the hashkafa, just the meaning and the ideas behind the brachas. And then afterwards, we'll tackle specifically the laws of suffix, doubt, if someone needs to recite the bracha. Mainly if someone is unsure if they recited the bracha in different scenarios, what the course of action would be in that case. So we have this idea of a bracha. We say a blessing. We bless Hashem every time that we eat something, and really goes much further than eating. We have brachas at all stages of the day. Right when a person wakes up, we have brachas. When a person finishes using the bathroom, there's bracha. There's brachas in davening. There's brachas over different sites and different things a person hears. So there's brachas throughout the day. So what's the idea of a bracha? So the first idea is from the Gemara Menachos, tells us that when the Pasuk says in the Devarim that Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, what does Hashem want from us? The only thing Hashem wants from us is to fear Him. Which the Gemara says Moshe Rabbeinu was saying on his level, that's a simple thing, but for us it's not a simple thing. But the Gemara Menachos says the word ma, what, can be understood to mean mea, 100, which teaches that there's an obligation. Many poskim hold the obligation. This specific obligation is on men, but there's an obligation to say, recite 100 blessings every day, 100 brachas every day. And that's learned from this pasuk of Ma, what does Hashem want to fear? And Chaim Friedlander points out that it's not a coincidence that it happens to be we have this word in Devarim, Ma, which just means, could sound like 100, but the Gemara is teaching us that a way to, a segue to be able to acquire fear of Yerushalayim is by saying the 100 brachas, the 100 brachas per day. And the idea is when we say a bracha, we say it with the right kavana, we say it with the right intent, and we understand we're saying, Hashem, you're the source of all blessing, you're the master of everything, you created everything, you control everything. When we say that, all these different points of our day, and he says that's why we the first thing we do when we wake up in the morning, we have Berachas HaShachar, we have Netilas Yadayim, we have the other Berachas HaShachar right when we wake up, because this is the way, whatever situation we're in our daily life, which might be mundane, seem mundane, we could bring Hashem in to every facet of it. He says an interesting thing of Chaim Friedlander, that the Mefarshim, the commentators say, that the 100 brachos that men were saying, men are obligated to say every day, it corresponds to the 100 sakets that were in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle in the desert. The Mishkan was the place where Hashem's Shechina was, where God's Shechina was, and the bottom of the Mishkan, the bottom of the boards of that tabernacle was held by Adonim, by sakets, and there were 100 sakets. The 100 brachos that we're saying every day, and even if women aren't obligated in that specific obligation of 100 brachos a day, they're also saying many brachos, and many of them maybe are saying those 100 brachos. That's the 100, it corresponds to the 100 sakets of the Mishkan. What's the idea? So Rav Chaim Friedlander says is that when we have our heart, we don't necessarily have a Beis HaMikdash, and especially now we don't have a shul, which is concerned Mikdash Ma'at, but we have the Beis HaMikdash of our hearts, which is the Yerushalayim, the fear of heaven that we have in our hearts. That's our Beis HaMikdash. And the sockets, the base of having that Yerushalayim, of recognizing and having awareness of Hashem at all times and situations, is built and is set up through this socket of 100 brachas every day. The brachas is the way to bring in Hashem, to bring in HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every part of our lives. That's one idea. The idea of a brachas is just something that any part of our daily life, we're recognizing Hashem in our world. The second idea, which will have to do with the halacha aspect of the shir, is that Gemara in brachas, in the sixth parak of brachas, said the obligation to say a bracha rishon, and say a bracha before eating food, is not scriptural, it's not from the Torah, it's rabbinic, and the reason why the rabbis instituted an obligation to make a bracha rishayna a bracha before partaking food is because asul adam lihanes min elam zel bracha. It's forbidden for a person to partake in any enjoyment and any pleasure of this world without first reciting the bracha. And the Gemara goes on to say that not only is it an obligation to recite a bracha before eating or drinking, but someone who partakes in food or drink without making the proper bracha, without making a bracha, it's as if he has stolen from Hashem, and it's as if he's used the kachim, the sanctified things for the Beis Hamikdash without he's used those things without permission. So I think the meaning over here is that when we eat something and when we're enjoying anything from the world, especially things that we have our own input into, so there's a danger that we're going to forget about Hashem. We're going to say, you know, I have this field here and I planted wheat and then I took the wheat and I ground it and I turned it into bread. There's a lot of human input, and with anything in the world, and especially with the human input, there's a danger that we'll forget about Hashem. We'll say, it's my strength, it's my ability, my smartness that got me all this stuff, when really we know it's from Hashem. So making the bracha, we're attributing that everything we have indeed does come from Hashem. I'm wondering if maybe that's why the more general bracha of Shahakal, which is not going into specifics as much, is was instituted on things that come from animals. When you the bracha is shown the before blessing on foods which grow from the ground and things which have a longer process in the hands of man needs an additional bracha. Something that grows from the ground needs hadama. Something, wine and bread, that there's more human involvement, has an even more specific bracha. Because the more we have our input, is the more of that danger that we'll say we're the ones who created all this, or it was our skill, and we'll forget about Hashem. So reciting the bracha, the Gemara says, Yishami, it's like the way we pay for partaking in this food. Before we make the bracha, it's stealing until we eat it. And by making the bracha, we have now removed that prohibition of stealing and of partaking in hektish. And now the bracha is what's actually in action, which is permitting the food to be partaken. So that's the second idea, that without a bracha, before eating food or drinking, it's like stealing. And by making the bracha, it's not stealing anymore. The third aspect is Hakar Satov, is thankfulness. We have to have gratitude to Hashem, which is similar, but is an added element that recognizing that we have to be grateful to Hashem helps us to feel the amount of debt that we ought to have to doing Hashem's will, to doing the mitzvot. By recognizing that Hashem was so good to us and he gave us such good food, now we realize that we have to go to the next step and serve Hashem and do his mitzvahs and perform better. I like to think that bracha rishayna, the bracha before eating, is the idea of acknowledging it came from Hashem and bypassing the stealing. And then the bracha hamazon and the bracha achrona is the thankfulness after we got permission to have it and we had it, and then afterwards we have to thank Hashem. So that's possibly a perspective specifically in the bracha rishon and the bracha achrona. So that's a third idea. And the fourth idea is, according to Kabbalah, we're taught that when Adam Rishon ate from the tree of knowledge, Eitz Hadas, so before then, all foods and things in this world were completely good. Everything was just clearly good, and the bad was all separate. But when Adam Rishon partook in the tree of knowledge, everything got mixed together, and now everything in the world, including food, has good and bad. All of it is mixed together. And by making a bracha, we're separating, in the spiritual way, we're able to separate the good, the good things that we need to get out of this fruit on the physical and the spiritual level, just like the body, breaks down the food and takes the nutrients and gets rid of the waste. So too, that's what we're doing with the bracha. We're able to sanctify and pull out the good part of the fruit and leave the waste. And that's on a Kabbalah, more of a Kabbalah idea. And just on a practical way of understanding that is that whenever we're doing something in this world, it's physical, it's mundane, it's not inherently spiritual, but by bringing whatever we're doing in this world, we're eating, which is technically animalistic, and we're putting into the framework of holiness and kedusha by making a bracha, so that actually uplifts the food and takes something physical and something that's not holy and makes it, it brings it up to the level of holiness. So those are a few ideas, the meaning behind brachos, and we can understand a lot better, and hopefully during the next week, some of the shirim will focus on some of the halachos about the intent and the knowledge that's necessary for brachos. It's striking when you learn the halachos of brachos how much of a focus and the concentration there are on the intent that a person has, on the understanding. Was he focusing? Did he interrupt his between eating and making the bracha? There's so much of a focus on the intent. We understand a lot better because a lot of the idea of a bracha is something that's it's intellectual and it's something for us to recognize and to be aware of. So that is the preface that I wanted to say. If anyone has a question on that, it might be a good time because the next in the middle I'll start the halacha. Anyone have any questions on that? Okay. So I wanted to talk about the halacha portion is the scenario where someone's unsure if they made a bracha, unsure if they need to make a bracha because they're unsure if they actually did make a bracha yet or not, which could be the bracha rishona, the bracha before eating. They're not sure. They were, let's say, sitting down for a meal. They set everything up, and then they sat down. They're talking to someone, and then they remind themselves that did I make a bracha? Did I not? They can't remember if they made a bracha, or the person ate a meal, and then they're ready to finish the meal. And so let's say they had to answer the phone or something, and they were technically done eating. Now they can't remember. Did they bench? Did they say the bracha achrona? What is the halacha in those scenarios? So I wanted to understand these halachas properly. It's probably in place to say two introductions to this. So first of all, there's a big rule which is very pertinent to what we're talking about. There's a big rule in the laws of brachas that safek brachas lahalacha. When in doubt with regard to a bracha, we are lenient, which typically means that if someone's unsure if they said a bracha, we're going to be lenient. They will not repeat the bracha. So it's important to understand the reason why this is so. And this is a special enactment that Chazal, the rabbis, made specifically with brachos, that whenever in doubt regarding a bracha, we are lenient, you don't recite a bracha. There's two reasons given. One reason is that since we explained that the bracha rishayna, the bracha before food, is rabbinic, it's not from the Torah. The general rule regarding rabbinic law is that when in doubt, we're lenient, which is not, you know, can't necessarily just always apply it on our own, but as a general rule, that's the way it works. So since the bracha rishayna, the before blessing, is rabbinic, when in doubt, we're lenient. That's one reason given, which we can understand that if we find a bracha that's going to be a Torah bracha from the Torah, that we will not be able to, this will not be applicable. The other reason that we say when in doubt of a bracha, we're lenient, is because when we're dealing with the question whether to make a bracha, which is necessary or not, so we, besides for having a question whether we're obligated to make a bracha, we also have a question if we're allowed to make a bracha, because the reason is we know we're not allowed to mention Hashem's name, God's name, in vain. And it's actually an avera to make a bracha when it's not necessary. That's called bracha vatol. So when we're analyzing a question, whether someone needs to make a bracha or not, besides for wondering whether the person is obligated, we have to also ask ourselves, are they permitted to make the bracha? Because if they do not need to make the bracha, it's a bracha vatol. So therefore, those are the two reasons given that when in doubt, you don't make another bracha. You don't make a bracha because, first of all, it's rabbinic, which is talking about bracha before food, which we'll get more into brachas after food. But a bracha which is rabbinic, we are lenient. And also, since making a bracha when you don't need to is a bracha vatal, there's a danger of transgressing the avera. That's why we say, when in doubt, it's better not to do anything, and therefore not transgress on that avera. So that is a rule regarding brachas in general. But the next introduction basically deals with what we started mentioning, is that some brachas are Torah brachas. Some brachas do have a source in the Torah, and therefore this rule of Sefik brachas, that when in doubt about a bracha, you're lenient, would not apply to those brachas. So it's important to first of all know that rule, but it's also important to know which brachas are rabbinic and which brachas are based in the Torah, and subsequently we can see whether we can apply the rule of Sefik brachas lahakel. So I will go quickly through the different brachas, which we're specifically talking about food brachas on food and drink, and then afterwards we'll go back and go through them practically to see the final halacha. But just on a general note, on the introductory note, benching, when someone ate bread, so if they ate enough bread to be satisfied, that is a Torah obligation to bench. We learn it from the pasuk in Ekev. If you eat and you're satisfied and you have to bench, you have to say the Berachas Hamazon, that is a Torah obligation. So, and that is regarding men. Regarding women, it's questionable whether or not Berachas Hamazon, when they were satisfied, is a Torah obligation. We'll see the halachic ramification of that question. Also, it's a question amongst the Rishonim whether or not the person needs to actually be satisfied for Berachas Hamazon to be a Torah obligation. Practically, we rule that a person needs to be satisfied for Berachas Hamazon to be a Torah obligation, and otherwise, it would mostly be rabbinic. But we'll see more about that later. And if someone was not satisfied and they ate a kezias, then that's the minimum amount to be obligated in Berachas Hamazon. If a person did not eat even a kezias, an olive volume of bread, then they do not recite Berachas Hamazon at all. So we're saying basically Berachas Hamazon sometimes could be a Torah obligation and sometimes could be rabbinic. With regards to Bracha Achrona, not on bread, and after blessing, not on bread, so we know there's the Bracha Achas Mein Shalosh Al Mechya, the blessing on species of the five grains and fruits of the seven species. So that is also questionable if that's a Torah obligation or not. And we will see more about the halachic ramification, but again, it's important to know just the background. And Barina Fashis, after blessing made on things which are shahakal, like drinks and poultry and cheese and the like, that is clearly rabbinic. As well as we mentioned, the bracha Rishona, the bracha before eating or drinking, is all rabbinic. So those are two basic concepts that we need to know, that there's this rule, self kebrachas lahakel, we're lenient when dealt with the bracha, but that's predicated on the bracha being rabbinic, which really depends on what bracha we're talking about and how the halacha is going to be. So now let's get back to the practical ramifications. So we'll start with bracha Rishona. Someone sat down for a meal, they have their food out, they brought a drink, they have food, and they were sitting there, they started talking to someone, and then they want to start eating, and then they realize they don't remember if they said a bracha before eating, and now they don't have to make any more bracha, or maybe they didn't make a bracha. So the halacha is, based on the rule of bracha v'hakel, when in doubt, we are lenient. So we are lenient, they do not need to recite a bracha. Someone is not sure if they made a bracha before eating, they have obviously reasonable doubt. If someone just totally spaced out and has no real reason to think they made a bracha Rishona, but they're nagging at themselves, maybe, then, you know, that's not enough of a suspicion that they made the bracha. But if a person has a serious reason, a good chance that they made the bracha Rishona, and they cannot remember if they did or not, they do not need to make another bracha. And this is there's actually some opinions who would hold that they would have to make a bracha, because we saw without making a bracha, it's stealing to eat. So those opinions say, you know, very nice, you're not sure if you made a bracha, but it's stealing. But the Shulchan Aruch rules that you do not need to make a bracha when in doubt in this case, because the way Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach explains is that the prohibition of stealing that we're talking about when we're eating without making a bracha was a rabbinic, when we talk about a serious prohibition of stealing, we're talking about a rabbinic prohibition that was based on the obligation to make a bracha. So since the rule is of bracha hakel, that when in doubt you do not recite the bracha, subsequently there will not be an issue of stealing either, at least in the structure of halacha. So therefore, again, someone is not sure if they made a bracha rishayna, the halacha is that they do not make another bracha, and not only do they not have to make another bracha, but the Mishnah rules, based on what we explained, it will be prohibited to make a bracha, to be machmir and make a bracha, because that will be a questionable bracha vatala, a bracha in vain. However, the Mishnah Berurah does add that if there's an easy way out of this doubt, for instance, let's say someone is sitting down for a meal with their family, and they're not sure if they made a bracha, but one of their family members has not eaten yet and is about to make a bracha, so it's commendable for a person in that case to ask a family member to be motzi them, to exempt them of the bracha by saying the bracha aloud, and they'll listen, and thereby you'll get around the doubt. So that's a commendable thing, but it's I think clear from the Mishnah Berurah that's not the strict halacha. Strict halacha is if you're not sure about bracha yishayna, you do not have to make a bracha. It's commendable if there's an easy way that happens to be. It's not you're not calling, you're not making someone eat something specifically to be most of you, or you're not running around looking for someone who's making that bracha right now. But it's just an easy solution right there. Then it's commendable to do that. But when in doubt, bracha yishayna will not be recited. That is regarding bracha yishayna, the bracha before you. Any questions on that? Nope. I think everyone's muted, so if you have a question, you probably have to unmute yourself. But I'm assuming there's no questions right now.
One question. If you say a bracha over a glass of water, for example, and you don't drink at all, and then you come back to it an hour later, do you have to say a bracha again?
You didn't drink anything at the time of the bracha?
Oh, no, I drank some of the water.
Oh, you drank some of the water, right?
And then there was still some water left, and then I come back to it an hour later. Do I say another bracha?
So that's a very good question, which I was hoping to address a whole shiur on that kind of a scenario where there was some sort of interruption between the bracha and you ate originally, but the subsequent eating there was some sort of interruption. So that's a little bit complicated subject, and I'm going to try to stay out of that question right now because I do hope to address that in a future shiur. Yeah, so that's definitely a very good question. Okay, so then I'll move to the after bracha on food. So we have benching. We mentioned if a man eats enough bread that he's satisfied, the benching is going to be a Torah obligation. And therefore, when in doubt, if he for whatever reason is not sure that maybe he benched, maybe he did not bench, maybe he said the berachas hamazon, he will have to bench again, the whole entire benching, all four blessings, when in doubt. In this case, where he knows that he had enough food to be obligated in benching on the Torah level. When we talk about satisfaction in this case, we're not just talking about he had enough bread to be satisfied from the bread itself, but we're talking about that he ate, he could be satisfied from eating other things that typically accompany bread in a sandwich, such as meat or fish or the likes. If someone had enough, he had at least the threshold of benching is a kizai. So you have to have at least an alv's worth of bread. But if someone had an alv's worth of bread and is satisfied either just from the bread or they ate other foods which can accompany bread in a sandwich, they are obligated in benching on the Torah level. And therefore, when in doubt, if they made the bracha, they would have to bench again. Let's say you have a man who did not eat enough to be satisfied, all he had was a kezayis, and now he's in doubt whether he recited the Berachas HaMazon. So the strict halacha is that he would not have to bench. Since we rule, even though we mentioned it's a disagreement amongst the Rishonim, the medieval authorities, if eating a kezayis of bread without being satisfied is a Torah obligation or a rabbinic obligation, we rule that it's rabbinic, and he would not have to bench again. However, the Mishnah brings from the Chai Adam, who writes that in deference to the opinion that the obligation to bench on for a man when he ate a kezayis is a Torah obligation, it's preferable or it's commendable for a person to wash again and eat another kezayis worth of bread with bracha. He would have to both, because he thought he may be benched, that tells us that he interrupted his thought process of the meal, and he would have to wash again, and he would have to make the bracha rishona of hamotzi again, eat a kezayis and then bench. That would be commendable, even when in doubt, for a man regarding if they benched after just eating kezayis. Similarly, if someone ate a kezayis of bread and they're full from things which don't accompany bread in a sandwich, but they're full from other things such as rice or kugel or something, or potatoes, something like that, it's also questionable whether or not that's a Torah obligation. And it would be commendable in that case for a person to do this idea of the chayadim, to wash again, to make the hamotzi bracha again, have a kezayis and olives worth of bread, and then to bench afterwards. So that is the main halacha for a man, is if he's obligated on a Torah level by being satisfied, then he has to bench again. If he's not obligated on a Torah level, he does not bench again, but it's preferable to put himself into a situation where he could bench again. Another way to get out of the doubt is if, similar to the bracha before food, if he finds someone who's benching, this used to happen in yeshiva. We had a dining room with a lot of boys eating at the same time. If someone, for whatever reason, had a doubt if they benched, they were able to ask the boy next to them who was about to bench to say Berachas HaMazon on their behalf, and they got around the question like that. So that is men. Regarding women, we mentioned that it's a question if they're obligated on the Torah level or not. I'll mention the reason why women may not be obligated in benching on the Torah level is because in the verse that tells us that we're obligated to recite Berachas HaMazon on the Torah level, it talks about inheriting the land, which that was something that was generally typical for men to inherit the land, even though there are situations where women could inherit the land. So therefore, there's the possibility that women are not obligated on the Torah level. They are still obligated on the rabbinic level, but that makes it a question over what to do when a woman who ate enough to have to bench is in doubt whether she benched or not. That becomes a big question based on this unclarity whether a woman is obligated on the Torah level. So if a woman ate only enough that she's not satisfied, so that's clearly, it's pretty clear that that's only a rabbinic obligation. So in that case, she would follow a man that she would not have to bench if she's in doubt whether she benched. However, if a woman ate enough to be satisfied, so in that event, it's probable that she should either have someone else recite the benching and she'll listen and she'll have them exempt her from obligation and thereby circumvent the doubt, or to do the option of the chayadim, to wash again, make hamotzi, and either gezayis and bench again. That will be commendable, just because this is it's a pretty big area of unclarity in halacha. However, for a woman, if for whatever reason it's difficult to do one of those options, there's no one around who's benching, or she feels too full, or she, for whatever reason, it's not easy for her to wash again, then a woman may follow either option of assuming that benching for her is a Torah obligation and she may bench again. That would be okay. We would not assume it's a bracha batala, since there are big poskim who hold she's obligated on the Torah level. And if a woman will want, in that case, she could also not bench and rely on the opinion that benching for women is always rabbinic, and that in the case of a doubt, she would not have to bench. So again, for a woman, if she did not eat enough that she's satisfied, then she does not need to bench again. if she ate enough to be satisfied, then it's preferable to find a way to get around the doubt. But if that is not possible or it's not easy, she may either bench or may not bench. That is regarding benching. When it comes to al-mechya or al-eitz, the blessing recited on the seven species, we find a similar thing, that if a person did not eat enough of those things to be really satisfied on the level of those things, you know, if you're eating grapes, you're not going to be satisfied like you just ate a bread meal, but you're satisfied from eating the grapes. So then that is a question of a Torah obligation. And therefore, when in doubt, strictly speaking, the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, rules that one may be lenient and not recite al-Mechya or al-Ha'etz or al-Gefen if they're in doubt whether they recited it, since the main ruling is that it's rabbinic. However, in deference to the opinion that al-Mechya is also a Torah obligation, it's preferable to eat enough that a person would have to make al-Mechya to eat something else or to eat the same item again, in order to obligate oneself to say al-Mechya either way and be able to recite the bracha achrona. And in that case, again, one would make the, meaning let's say someone had enough cake to have to make al-Mechya and then they can't remember if they made al-Mechya, so it's commendable, preferable to, let's say, have some pasta and have to make al-Mechya again. And in that case, when they start eating the pasta, they would have to make a new bracha rishonim. They have to make a new mezainis. Since the mere fact that they're in doubt whether they recited the after bracha, the bracha achrona, tells us that they probably were not, they were not in the frame of mind of eating the original meal, and they would have to make a new bracha. So that's regarding al hamechya. And when it comes to berin nefashis, we mentioned that berin nefashis is clearly a rabbinic obligation, and therefore, if someone, let's say, they drank some water or drink some juice or had some cheese, and now they know that they at one point had an obligation to make a berin nefashis, they don't remember if they did it. So then, also in that case, when they're in doubt, they will not have to make the bracha again because of this rule that safek brachas is lahakel. When in doubt on a rabbinic bracha, we are lenient. That's the shir. And if anyone has any questions, happy to answer anything.
Yeah, someone was asking a question in my house. So a woman that on the whole deraisa, the whole birchas of Muslim is a rabbinical. So anytime they have a question, like if they benched, let's say on a Shabbos, they forgot to say, or Yom Rosh Chodesh, they didn't say Yalv Yavai. They would still have to repeat themselves, or that makes it a suffix derabanan.
Rosh Chodesh, I don't think anyone repeats for Yalv Yavai.
I'm in Yantif, I'm sorry.
Yantif is a separate shiloh, because they might not be obligated in Simchas Yantif, because it might be a Mitzvah Shazman Groma. I think that's Machloikas. But Shabbos, my understanding is even if a man's doubtful if he said Ritzeh, my understanding is that's not...
I don't mean to get into the back and forth of which days you do it. No. I'm asking the question simply that is it automatically every suffix that a woman has with benching doesn't automatically mean you go suffix to Rabbanan Kula, right? That's all I'm saying.
Well, we're saying that there's a big possibility that it's not the Rabbanan. There's a lot of Paiskim Rishonim that hold it to the Raisa. So that's what we're saying. They could rely on that if they want. You know, if a woman knows for her, it's hard to bench again. So there's a big place to rely on Safek Derabanan Kula. If there's a way to get around it, that's better. And if she feels she wants to be machmir, she wants to bench, then the Mishpura says she can do that also. So really, it's not really clear. It's not. I think the answer is.
Got it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.